Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we are going to have a very interesting talk about how veterans can help bridge the civil-military divide. And I'm very happy to have Crispin Burke with us today. And he wrote a piece that is titled this, How Veterans Can Help Bridge the Civil-Military Divide. And it was published in The Atlantic on the 13th of November, 2017, just in case you're listening to this show in another year. But yeah, Crispin had some really great thoughts in this. I thought it would be a fantastic discussion considering that we do have a lot of service men and women that listen to our show that have been guests, veterans, as well as civilians and security community people. So first of all, I would love to wish you a great welcome to the Loopcast, Crispin, and thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
For our listeners, Crispin is an active duty Army officer and an Iraq War veteran, and he has served in the 82nd Airborne Division. He also is a defense blogger, so some of you might have seen his work before. He's been published in outlets such as War on the Rocks, Small Wars Journal, and The Atlantic, as we just mentioned that this article was recently published in. So he's got a nice background in publications and, of course, experience being a serviceman for the U.S. Army. So first of all, thank you for your service as well, Crispin.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So why don't we start off with discussing what inspired you to write this piece?
Well, I wrote this piece just shortly before Veterans Day, and as you said, it came out on the 13th, the Monday following Veterans Day. And usually on Veterans Day, a lot of pundits take the opportunity to explore what we call the civil-military divide in America, which is to say that civilians in the military are culturally and even physically separate from one another. And many of these pieces are generally written by civilians. I had a book just recently edited by Corey Shockey and General James Mattis, in which it was an anthology work, and most of the contributors to this anthology, which explored civil-military relations, were civilians. And they generally concluded that civilians don't understand the military. But I think that we as service members have an equal obligation to understand the American public. So it's the public that our soldiers come from, it's the public we serve, and it's the public that we will eventually return to as veterans.
Ed, why don't you describe this concept of the civil-military gap in your personal experience as well as the general concept? What is it for those that might want to know more in detail?
Okay. So the civil-military divide refers to the disconnect between service members and civilians, and that applies both at an individual level and at kind of the greater level between society and the military itself. So just to go over a couple of facts to show you how profound this civil-military divide is. There was a survey recently which suggested that less than half of Americans have ever interacted with a U.S. service member, their spouse, ever in their lifetime. So socially, we're more distant. There's also a physical aspect to this as well. Half of all U.S. service members are in just 5 states of the Union: California, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, and Virginia. So this isn't just a feeling. I mean, you can actually physically see this on the ground.
What sort of issues does the civil-military gap or divide, whichever you'd like to call it, what type of issues does it cause?
It causes issues at both the micro level and the macro level. So the micro level, person-to-person interaction between service members and civilians. There are a lot of stereotypes of soldiers and veterans. I'm going to kind of lump them all into one group here. So you really have about 3 stock stereotypes of service members and veterans. So the first one is the super soldier, right? The Call of Duty, the SEAL Team 6. I think there are now 3 TV shows now this season that feature either SEAL Team 6 or some elite commando units, the people you see in the recruiting posters all the time. That's one stereotype. The second stereotype, and I think this is probably just as harmful, is the stereotype of the broken veteran. And there's a lot of very well-intentioned reporting on issues such as post-traumatic stress, on homelessness of veterans. But I think a focus on those issues has led many Americans to believe that service members and veterans are these ticking time bombs, that they're victims, that they joined the military because they had no other options in life. And that's not the case. But this stereotype, I think, is very harmful because, as I was studying the issue of veteran employment once, there are some employers who are reluctant to hire veterans because they think that veteran is going to snap. They think that veteran is going to shoot people because they saw it in a movie, they saw it on a TV show, there might have been a highly publicized event, and that's really not the case with post-traumatic stress. I think that's also a very harmful stereotype. There's a third one, and there's one that we kind of bring it on ourselves, and that's the disgruntled veteran. These are the guys that you're now starting to see a lot more on the internet. They're vocal, they're obnoxious, and they're out there to really offend and sneer at anybody who didn't serve in the military. And that's a very small segment of our population, but I think that that small segment of the population has let pride in service turn into arrogance. And that's also a very harmful stereotype that people are starting to have about veterans, that they're just angry, bitter human beings. And that's a stereotype that I think that a small minority of us have done to ourselves. And I think that's also very harmful, not in terms of the way we are perceived by the American public, but also by antagonizing the people that we're trying to reintegrate with, we further exacerbate the civil-military divide. And again, that's a very small minority of veterans, but that is a concern that I have with stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the micro level. Now, at the macro level, in order to have a thriving democracy, leaders, the civilian electorate, and the voters need to make informed decisions about where and when this nation goes to war and what resources we give our military to achieve those goals. And are the resources commensurate with our objectives? And do we need to scale one or more back? For the military, it means that we need to understand but not interfere with the political context of the wars. So to give you an example, if you were to ask Americans what they thought about pretty much any issue in politics, just pick an issue, they'd be very willing to give you their opinion. But when it comes to military affairs, so an issue such as women in the military or funding or things like that, Americans are much more likely to say, well, I don't know. In other words, people, both the electorate and the elected officials, are much more willing to kind of abdicate their civil responsibilities. They're much more willing to defer to the military on those issues. And that's not really that healthy for democracy because in our country, we have a very strong tradition of civil control of the military. One of the most surprising things I learned, if you've ever read L.A. Cohen's Supreme Command, is that he suggests that heads of state who are generally more involved in military affairs tend to be more successful than those who don't. And to just kind of give you an example of how checked out the American public is, you probably read or heard about that ambush in Niger. And many Americans, and including some lawmakers, were quite shocked to hear that we had troops in Niger. But this wasn't a secret. If you go to the DoD website, every quarter they'll tell you how many troops are in what country. And for the last few quarters, the DoD had been reporting hundreds of troops in Niger. Nobody ever bothered to check that out. Nobody cared. So I think that in that aspect, this civilian electorate and the voters and the public are not really doing their jobs in terms of staying informed on military affairs. And I think that's harmful for democracy. The military, for its part, doesn't always understand democracy. Have you guys seen the movie War Machine?
Yes.
The one about Stanley McChrystal? I watched it with my family this Thanksgiving. I think that's probably a good dark comedy about the war in Afghanistan. But what's kind of intrigued me about General McChrystal is that he got in hot water long before the Rolling Stone article was published due to the leaked assessment and the perception that he was trying to box the administration in with the request for more troops. And I think that he was sincere about winning the war, about defeating the Taliban, about defeating the insurgency, but I don't know that he really understood what America was going through at that time. You know, just to keep the war in Afghanistan going, it took $400 to deliver a gallon of gas to a combat outpost in Afghanistan. Just the sheer logistics of sustaining that war, it was just massive in a landlocked country. We were asking for that at the same time that the United States had gone through a massive financial meltdown. And I think that we simply didn't understand the effect that that had on the American public. We're asking for the American public to pay $400 for a gallon of gasoline when the stock market had just crashed, people lost their retirements, their home values plummeted, massive unemployment. So I think in that sense, that episode kind of represented how estranged the military itself is from the society it serves.
And do you find that in the field, so in the military, that there is also this prevalent feeling among the service members that this divide exists, or is this just a handful of people talking about it versus the majority of service men and women just going about their duties every day?
Well, I'm going to go back to my article. I start with an anecdote. I don't tell the full story in the article, but I'll tell it here. But I start by talking about a conversation I had about 2014. And it was during the summer of 2014. And during that summer, that was when ISIS had really broken out of Syria and they had swept through northern Iraq. And for Iraq War veterans, that was very disheartening to see everything that you'd worked for over a one-year deployment, and in some cases, many service members had served multiple year-long deployments in Iraq, just completely evaporate in a matter of really days. And over that summer, you just saw one setback after another. And one of those setbacks, and tragedies really, was the decapitation of journalists who were captured in Iraq. And somebody saw that news story and said, made the remark, Americans don't care about things like this. They only care about gay marriage. And I think that quote there highlights where I think there was a disconnect between the military and the society we serve. And there's a general sense in the military that Americans have very frivolous concerns. General David Barna, when he came back from Afghanistan, wrote in War of the Rocks that he was amazed at how much Americans care about entertainment, tabloids, and sports. But I think that comment that Americans cared about gay marriage more than somebody who was decapitated shows how estranged we are from the public. This was 2014. It was not that long after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So this person may not have known many days in the military. But for many Americans in civil society, that was a legitimate civil rights issue and a hard-fought one at that. And to this day, I mean, you may not have seen it much in 2014, but I recently deployed thousands of soldiers to Iraq, and same-sex couples were saying their goodbyes just like regular couples. It's something that we've grown accustomed to, but I think that episode there represented how estranged we are from the concerns of maybe the public we serve and the perception that Americans have simply checked out or care about frivolous things, when that may not necessarily be the case.
And as you mentioned earlier in the talk, there are certain states here in the U.S. that have the majority of service men and women stationed in those states due to bases and so forth, and hubs, you can put it that way. Do you think that also helps to create this civil-military divide in the sense that many servicemen and women do live on bases, and unless they're going out into town for certain things or a night on the town or a dinner or something like that, they maybe don't interact so much with the locals. Is that an issue?
I think so. And if you look at the Army in particular, this is true to all the branches to a certain extent, but I think it affects the Army in particular because the Army builds its bases or has, due to a number of historical factors and the fact that the land is cheap, in rural areas in the South where there's simply not that many people in the local community. And I think that further exacerbates the civil military divide. There aren't that many military bases near major cities, Army bases in particular.
And so after talking about some of the issues that we've unraveled so far, what does this mean for the future of civilian and non-civilian relations? It sounds like we do have a growing issue here that, if left unchecked, it can create even more of a divide versus bringing individuals together and creating better understanding.
And I think you are correct that this is going to become a growing problem. And just a few statistics. Right now, veterans make up about 7% of the U.S. population. There are about 20 million veterans in the U.S., veterans defined as those who have served in it, separated from the military, so not counting anybody still in the military, 20 million. But over the next 20 years, that number is going to decrease to approximately 13 million, even as the American population is obviously going to grow. So in the next 20 years, veterans, which now make up 7% of the population, will probably make up 3.5% of the population. So the proportion of veterans in the population is going to decrease by about 50%. That's according to the VA. There's a second trend that I think is probably just as concerning, is that the strongest indicator as to whether or not somebody will join the military isn't race, class, background, or anything like that. It's whether or not you had a parent or close family member who served in the military. And there's a great podcast put on by the 82nd Airborne Division about every 2 weeks. And they recently interviewed soldiers returning from Mosul in Iraq. And every soldier, when interviewed, talked about the service members and their family. They would interview a soldier, and that soldier would talk about their brother, their father, their cousins, who all served in the military. It's increasingly becoming a family business. And I think that in the United States, military service is now starting to be seen as something that others do. I mean, service members have children who now enter the military, and civilians who have little exposure to the military aren't considering military service as an option. So, yes, I think that is further exacerbating the civil-military divide.
Mm. So what are the benefits of being a service member, and what would you say are the downsides of being a service member in regards to being part of society and civilian society as a whole, so blending civilian and non-civilian life?
Okay, so as annoying as it is to keep moving every few years, it exposes me to different parts of the country and different parts of the world. Whereas I look at people my age, they may not have moved out of their city or their small town or their state. So I think it's amazing that I've been able to see a good portion of the world at my age. The downside, though, in terms of civil-military relations, is that it can be difficult to understand and empathize with your local community, especially if you're only going to be there a few years, and even more so if you live within the confines of the base. Adding to that is the fact that many service members don't pay taxes to whatever local community they're living in. They either pay taxes in their home state, or based on the way these tax rules are written, they may not pay any state income tax. Some states don't have income taxes, so that really kind of forces them to kind of check out of local affairs where most civilians can't. They have to be involved in their community. So as you move from duty station to duty station, you don't have a sense of belonging to a community.
And then there's been a lot of talk about qualifications to enlist in the military services here in the States. I was wondering if you could discuss this a bit, because you do discuss it in your article. So what are these, A? And then I'd like to move on to sort of the different standards that were acceptable versus new standards that are being allowed to join the service here in the States.
Okay, so this is for the Army specifically, but it generally applies to all the branches. First, you have to have either a GED or a high school diploma, the high school diploma being preferred to the GED. Second is that you have to meet certain intellectual standards. So think of your SATs or any other standardized tests. Every service member going to the recruiting station has to take this test, and you'll be scored from the 0 percentile to the 99th percentile. The Army is prohibited from taking anybody from the bottom 10 percentile. And there are restrictions on those who score between the 10th percentile and the 30th. So no more than 4% of recruits can come from that cohort. So no more than 4% of recruits can come from the 10th to the 30th percentile. Adding on to that is that the Army must take 60% of its recruits from the top 50%. So greater than half must be in the above average cohort. All right, adding on to that, you have your medical requirements. So asthma, physical ability, things like that. Obesity restricts people from military service. Some physical fitness tests. So that can be much more difficult for today's generation to meet the physical fitness requirements with the obesity epidemic, and with the elimination of PE in schools. We're finding a lot of soldiers don't have the ability to do complex movements like tumble or navigate an obstacle course. And then finally, there's a couple of outlying factors like felony convictions, single parenting, and things like that. So those standards might not seem that high, you know, just to have a GED, clean criminal record, and above 50 percentile intelligence, but they're high enough that studies vary, but between 70 and 75% of Americans cannot, between the ages of 17 and 24, cannot meet those standards. And like I said, those are the bare minimum standards. What the military really wants to get are what's called, quote-unquote, high-quality recruits. So those with a high school diploma, not a GED, high school diploma, greater than 50% on the intelligence quotient, and, again, clean criminal record. If you take that population, just 12.7% of the American youth cohort, 17 to 24, or about 4.2 million Americans, can meet that standard. And the armed forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, have to recruit 200,000 people from that cohort.
Wow.
And, every year.
And this is a great way of transitioning into my next question, which is talking about these enlistment standards. And as I mentioned before the first question that I just asked, there's discussions on easing these a bit because the services do want to attract new recruits. So what are your thoughts on this? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What might be the results?
So to ask whether or not the standards are changing, the standards necessarily are not changing, but there are some disturbing trends. Let me go into that one. So we haven't actually modified the standards per se. However, we're looking at some disturbing trends with recruit quality. So as we talked before, the DoD says that the Army cannot recruit more than 4% from that cohort of the 10th percentile to the 30th percentile, right? Well, we haven't exceeded that. Right now, 1.9% of recruits are coming from that cohort, right? So we're below that 50% threshold. We're below half of that 4% threshold. However, there's a disturbing trend. Last fiscal year, 0.6% of recruits came from that cohort between 10 and 30 percentile intelligence. And in 2013, just 0.2% came to the 10th to 30th percentile. So over the last 4 years, we've seen a 9 or 10-fold increase of service members who are coming into the Army who are scoring between 10 and 30 percentile on the intelligence quotient test. And that's a disturbing trend. Secondly, is that this isn't necessarily a modification to the standards per se, but recruiters have always been able to issue waivers for prior use of marijuana. And I don't know that that's necessarily a hit on recruit quality. You could, Sina, I know you're living in Colorado. Correct me if I'm wrong. Can you legally smoke marijuana in Colorado at the age of 18? Sina?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. I know apparently in Colorado and a number of U.S. states, that's not even a crime. So recruiters, I think, are much more willing to issue waivers for prior use of marijuana because as American society, or at least in several states, we've already crossed that threshold. You cannot smoke it while in military service. You can't use any, even if it's legal within your state. We still have mandatory drug tests, and you cannot smoke marijuana while serving the military. And I think that's a consistent statement with a number of professions. If you want to join the airlines and you're based in Colorado, guess what? You can't smoke marijuana even though it's legal in your state. A number of professions have this restriction.
Which I think another, is a good thing. I wouldn't want my airline pilots smoking marijuana and flying a 747.
I mean, we do have mandatory drug testing, 10% a month and 100% every year. So we do screen for that while you are in service. However, if a prior recruit has smoked marijuana, that might not even be an indicator of criminal activity. That could be legal in their area. So the other trend that we're starting to see is that we've reduced the waiver authority for certain mental health issues. So now the head of U.S. Army Recruiting Command or your state adjutant general, if you're joining the National Guard, can sign off on a waiver if you have certain mental health problems. And there are two ways to look at this, is that, A, it's much easier to diagnose a child with a mental health issue today, and sometimes we do so to ridiculous levels. Schools get credit for having children with ADHD in their classroom, and they get a certain amount of funding. Or imagine every teenager, if every we rejected every teenager who ever had depression, we would never fill our ranks. So there are waivers being issued for that, and I think that's legitimate. What I think people are balking at is that the Army in particular is considering waivers for those with bipolar disorder or self-harm, and I think that's something we need to just look at a little bit more carefully. I don't know how many waivers were actually issued, and the reduction of the waiver authority actually puts the Army in line with the other services, so it's not that the Army itself is lowering its standards below that of the other services. It's now coming in line with the other services, but that could be a trend worth watching, I think, in the future. And I don't think that we are anywhere near the issues we had from 2005 through 2009 with the waivers for felony convictions and things like that. So, again, there are some trends worth looking at in terms of the mental health of soldiers and with the mental aptitude of soldiers, I think. But I don't think that they're anywhere near crisis levels yet.
And I'm just going to make a disclaimer here because I'm sure some people are wondering why I've asked these questions about enlistment standards and the process and so forth. But this whole talk is about the civilian and military divide. And there may be people that are listening to the show that have no clue how this works. So I figured it's good to have this platform to provide information and knowledge on how you can enlist in the services. So moving on to personal experiences, you are a service member, Crispin, so you've got this platform. What is it that you would like civilians to know about, and how do you see this divide coming together from your own personal experiences?
Well, I think that it's important for civilians to know that service members are just regular human beings just like they are. We do a different job, but deep down, when we take off our uniform at the end of the day, we're just like everybody else. We put on our pants one leg at a time. And we just ask that America stay informed on the issues which affect us, both in terms of when they place service members in harm's way, agree or disagree. We just want to make sure that everybody has an informed opinion on these sorts of issues, and also on how they think the military should be structured. Get involved in democracy, because ultimately you're paying for it with your tax dollars.
You're a new guest on the Loopcast. We like to give our guests a moment, if time permits, which it does today, to have a final thought or touch on something that we might not have discussed in the talk. So I'd like to hand over the floor to you.
Okay. So some final thoughts. So as a shameless plug, I had the opportunity to talk about a number of these issues in terms of civil-military relations in a small chapter in a book that's coming out called Strategy Strikes Back, in which I take a look at civil-military relations in the context of Star Wars. For instance, I've always wondered, do the stormtroopers get health care? Do they get, like, good family housing or educational benefits? Probably not, because it's the evil empire. But, you know, what can we learn from the way from Star Wars, from the stormtroopers and the clone troopers, that could apply to civil-military relations in our galaxy? It's going to be an interesting book. I have just one small chapter and among a number of fantastic authors who are going to explore all sorts of issues in that galaxy and apply them to our galaxy. Spoiler, Max Brooks is going to look at the issue of why the Rebel Alliance stopped funding and supporting the Ewoks after these Ewoks had partnered with American forces or partnered with the Rebel forces and defeated the Empire. The rebels just pulled all their support and their funding. You know, what's up with that? Who does that? That's such a jerk move. Why would that ever happen? I can't think of anybody who would ever do something like that. But yeah, it's going to be coming out this May. It's called Strategy Strikes Back. It's going to be a great book.
It sounds really fun, actually. So I'll have to look for that. I want to thank you for coming on the show, Crispin, and sharing your thoughts and your experiences. And just thank you, and thank you for your service to the United States. And good luck with the book chapter and the book coming
out. Oh, yes. Disclaimer, none of my views spoken on this podcast are in any way that of my employer.
Okay, good. Disclaimers are always good. We like those. But thank you so much.
I got to stay out of trouble. I got a job.
Very true. I completely understand. Well, thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast.
Okay. Hey, thanks. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.